Welcome to Attack the System Radio, a program dedicated to pan-anarchism against the state and pan-secessionism against the empire, with Keith Preston. Politicians hide themselves away. They only started the war. Why should they go out to fight? They leave their all to the poor.
Welcome to Attack the System. I'm your host, Keith Preston, coming to you from attackthesystem.com. It is Sunday evening, September the 8th, 2013. Tonight, I want to go back and take a look at some things that we have discussed at attackthesystem.com over the years in light of recent events. Of course, as we all know, the big thing that's going on in the world right now is the issue with Syria. And I've got another podcast that is either up now or will be up soon where I get into my own analysis of the Syria question in a little bit more detail. But one thing that this issue of what's going on with Syria does is that it gives us the opportunity to go back and look at some of the things that we have been talking about at attackthesystem.com for quite some time now. In particular, one of the things that we have always talked about is the question of the left and the right, of the need to reject the left and the right with equal fervor. Now, of course, of all of our associates and readers and supporters at Attack the System, our contributing writers and our casual readers and all of the people who are a part of our inner and outer circle, all of us come from many different kinds of backgrounds. Some of us come from the left, some of us come from the right. In my particular case, I'm probably as much of an oddity as anyone. I spent the 70s among the religious right. I spent the 80s among the radical left. I spent the 90s among the populist right. And then I went off in the 2000s in my own direction and started developing my own projects. Whatever backgrounds we come from at Attack the System, one thing that we have pushed is the need to move past this whole left-right dichotomy, that the both the established left and the established right are intellectually and politically bankrupt in many ways, and we need something beyond that, beyond the left and right. There's a slogan that I've heard in some of the European New Right circles and radical traditionalist circles and Eurasianist circles and so forth. That I think is fairly applicable, and that is neither left nor right, but against the center. And what that really means is that, you know, whatever else we may be, philosophically, politically, culturally, we tend to oppose the status quo. We certainly oppose the establishment. There's obviously no doubt about that. But then we also criticize fairly strongly a lot of the currents that we find on both the left and on the right as well. So what we've endeavored to do at Attack the System for quite some time is to develop a new kind of movement that perhaps draws on various currents of both the left and the right for the sake of attacking the center, but is really neither a left-wing nor a right-wing movement. And of course, at Attack the System, we also have the added feature of being anarchists. Most of the people who contribute to our projects are anarchists or anarchist fellow travelers of some type. And we've essentially created a whole new kind of political movement, or I won't say we're necessarily large enough to be a movement at this point, but certainly a whole new type of tendency that I think is rather unique. There's not much else out there like it. There's some other currents, some other tendencies that overlap with us a little bit. But what we're doing is fairly original, I think. And of course, with the projects that we do at Attack the System, like promoting a type of anarchism that's neither left nor right, but against the center. Of course, we've published a lot of original material over the years, written by myself and by others, outlining some of these philosophical ideas a little bit more thoroughly and a little bit more comprehensively. And tonight, I want to go back and review some of that and discuss some of the ideas that we have talked about and written about at Attack the System for quite some time now, in light of recent events, in light of what's going on with Syria and all the things that the Syria crisis represents. 10 years ago, I published an article on attackthesystem.com called Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire. Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire. You can go to our homepage and look at the section on the left-hand side of the page that says Core Documents and access that essay. I wrote that back in 2003, and it's really the most comprehensive statement of the ideas that we promote at Attack the System, I think, that any of us have ever written. It's a fairly lengthy essay. It's very detailed. It's a fairly detailed manifesto that really outlines the gist of the Attack the System philosophy and strategy. And, of course, there's a companion piece to that was written a few years later called Liberty and Populism, where we're taking the core ideas that are outlined in Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire, and we apply it to to North America, in particular the United States, in a specifically strategic context. And going back and looking over some of this material and looking at a lot of other material that we've published at Attack the System, it's interesting how precision some of that material was in terms of predicting things that are going on today. Now, that doesn't mean that that's cause for celebration. Sometimes it sucks to be right. It really does, because there were a lot of negative predictions that were made in some of those materials, some of those old essays that unfortunately have come into fruition, and it would have been better for everyone involved if we had been wrong. So it does sometimes suck to be right. But I want to go back and take a look at some of that because it's really very important to the broader set of ideas that we promote at Attack the System. In Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire, one of the first things that I attack in that essay written 10 years ago is what I call democratism, this concept of democratism. And, of course, that's not a term that we really hear a lot of in mainstream political discourse, not by any means, mainstream political discourse teaches that mass democracy of the kind that we have come to experience in Western societies is a positive thing. It's a wonderful thing. It's something that is really the pinnacle of human achievement. It's the best system there is. It's the best system there could ever be. We hear that over and over and over again. All of us who went through the school system heard that when we were growing up. We've all heard it over and over again from the media. We've heard it from just about every corner we can think of, this idea that isn't democracy wonderful? And of course, democracy is just a euphemism for the kind of centralized managerial states that we have in virtually all of the modern countries, something where the state interferes in every aspect of life and every aspect of society. And justifies this in the name of the people. Well, the people elected us, so we must be doing right, or anything we the state do is right because, hey, the people can vote us out if they want, right? And that's really the foundation of the state's claim to legitimacy in modern societies, is this whole concept of ritualistic voting, this whole idea that because people get to go to the polls every few years and pull a lever for Tweedledee or Tweedledum, then anything the state does is justified. Meanwhile, the state continues to try to expand its powers to ever more totalitarian levels and to interfere in ever more areas of life, to eradicate an ever greater number of previously existing zones of autonomy. Now, one of the best books about that, of course, is by Hans Hermann Hoppe. Hans Hermann Hoppe is a libertarian economist in the Austro-libertarian tradition who's written very critical of mass democracy in its modern form. He's really one of the few writers that really tackles this issue head-on and points out its weaknesses. And he draws somewhat from the previous work of Eric von Kuhnert-Lardin. And, of course, these are critiques of mass democracy that are from the right, or at least what would be thought of as the right in contemporary discourse. But you also find very similar criticisms of mass democracy in writers that are normally associated with the left, particularly some of the older anarchist writers like Proudhon, like Kropotkin, also some of the classical liberal writers like John Stuart Mill. There's a wide assortment of thinkers. H.L. Mencken, who were very skeptical of mass democracy and where it would take civilization. And a lot of the criticisms of mass democracy that we see in these thinkers that I just referred to are in turn derivative of insights of the ancient philosophers, the ancient Greek philosophers, who likewise criticized mass democracy as it was practiced in their time, Aristotle, Plato, and others. It's long been recognized by intelligent political theorists of any type that mass democracy inevitably breeds authoritarianism and tyranny, because a state that tries to be everything to everyone ends up being nothing to no one. And a state of that type invites rule by the demagogue. A state of that type, in the name of trying to appeal to an ever greater variety of constituents, finds it necessary to interfere in every aspect of life. And we can see this continuing to unfold in the modern societies. Now, in that essay, Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire, I wrote that in 2003, in the summer of 2003, right when the war in Iraq was beginning. The Bush, George W. Bush regime had just invaded Iraq a few months earlier when I wrote that essay, and of course the text and content of that essay reflects that, because there's a lot of references to that. But one thing that I say in that essay is I discuss the neoconservatives in some detail, and I talk about the role of the neoconservatives in pursuing the war in Iraq. And I compare the neoconservatives with that with the beliefs of the liberal internationalists. The neocons tend to be unapologetic American imperialists. One of their leading theoreticians is a fellow named William Crystal, and for a long time he's pushed this idea of national greatness, which was just a euphemism for the glory of the empire, the glory of the fatherland. I mean, he could just as easily be some ancient Roman state propagandist or something like that, or he could have just as easily be played a similar role in the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany or one of those kinds of states as well. But that's really what this guy argues for, is just an unapologetic imperialism. He's the son of Irving Kristol, who was really one of the godfathers of the neoconservative movement. And Kristol likewise had that kind of perspective. He was a very strong advocate of unilateral, aggressive American imperialism, unapologetically so. And the liberal internationalist can be contrasted in some ways with the neoconservatives, because the liberal internationalists really believe that it's best to be a little bit more subtle about some of these kinds of things, while they ultimately have the same goal. They ultimately have the same goal as the neoconservatives, and that is preservation and expansion of the empire. They think it's generally best to act through international institutions to try to build a stable consensus with supposed American allies and puppet states and things like that. for the sake of maintaining the stability of the empire in the long haul. So that's the liberal internationalist point of view. Now, I also mentioned in the essay Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire that the liberal internationalist would likely be eclipsed eventually. Rather, the neoconservatives would likely be eclipsed by the liberal internationalist. And the reason for that, one of the reasons for that, is that the neocon wars of the last decade would turn out to be such a disaster. And in fact, they have. We see now with this Syria crisis that the overwhelming majority of the American public has very little interest in going to war with Syria. And I suspect the average American looks at this like, well, we did Iraq, we did Afghanistan, what do we got to do this for? Not another one, so to speak. I think that seems to be the average person's attitude. And that's a positive thing. In and of itself, that's a positive thing. I've said in these podcasts before that ever since the end of the Vietnam War, one thing that's been great about the legacy of the Vietnam War is that the public will no longer accept imperialist war if it involves any sacrifice on their part. If it involves the imposition of a military draft, if it involves very high casualties on the American side, if it involves things like the imposition of war taxes and rationing and the things that in past times were taken for granted during wartime. So ever since the Vietnam War, there's been absolutely no enthusiasm for that kind of stuff. And I think that one positive side effect that the war in Vietnam had was that it pretty much killed the enthusiasm of people in the modern countries for imperialist war pretty much for good from what I've been able to see. And of course, those states are starting to lose their legitimacy in it. That's been strengthened, that tendency has been strengthened by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Even those wars were fairly mild in terms of their casualties for the American side when compared to older wars like those in Korea and Vietnam. But even those wars, the public's gotten tired of. The public was always, somewhat, at least had somewhat mixed feelings about. And now it seems like now that the Obama regime is pushing war with Syria, there's less enthusiasm for this war than there was for the wars in Afghanistan or Iraq. So that's a positive development in terms of overall cultural and social trends. But one thing that's interesting is that now that the liberal internationalists have returned to power, the neocons have been put out of office. Of course, the neocons became successful by seizing control of the Republican Party, forming an alliance with the right wing of the military-industrial complex, and becoming the intellectual leadership of the so-called conservative movement, and getting control of the Defense Department. That's how they were able to take the United States into these wars. They've been formally displaced through the change of regime that came about. Obama became the president of the United States. And now the liberal internationalists are in the driver's seat. But what's interesting about that is that even though some of the rhetoric may be slightly different, we don't really see that much actual change in American foreign policy. In fact, one thing that American foreign policy has is a great deal of continuity, irrespective of who is in power, irrespective of who the individual president is, of what party is the ruling party at the time. I remember back in 1992 when Bill Clinton was elected. Well, actually, it was after his inauguration, which would have been in early 1993. But I remember seeing him on television giving a press conference. And this was his first press conference after assuming the presidency. And the first thing he said is, "We want to assure the international community of the continuity of our foreign policy." In other words, he was basically saying, there may be a new sheriff in town, but the laws are still the same. That's really what he was saying. There's that American foreign policy is going to be the same, irrespective of who the actual president is, who the actual ruling party is. And, of course, that fits in with things that we talk about at Attack the System, because we, as much as any political faction out there, reject this whole Democratic-Republican dichotomy. We reject this left-right dichotomy. There's a lot of people out there, liberals and conservatives, who have this idea that, well, you know, maybe the Democrats just aren't quite as bad as the Republicans, or maybe the Republicans just aren't quite as bad as the Democrats. And a line that at least I have pushed for quite some time, a couple of decades at least, is that no, there's not a dime's worth of difference between either one, particularly when it comes to foreign policy. Now that the liberal internationalists are in power, we see them essentially doing the same thing that the Bush regime, under the leadership of the neoconservatives, did in Iraq. We see the liberal internationalists doing this in Syria. We see them faking reports about atrocities involving chemical weapons, just as the Bush regime faked reports about weapons of mass destruction. We see the Obama regime desperately trying to put together an international coalition of the willing, and finding that there's the willing are few and far between, and that's similar to the experience that the Bush administration had in their run-up to the war in Iraq. We see Congress being pushed to approve a war in Iraq, and Congress going about it in a half-assed manner. On one hand, they know the public's not that happy. I mean, a war in Syria, they know the public's not that happy about this idea. But on the other hand, they're pressured by the various elite and ruling class interests that are behind them. So it's really very similar. You know, we see John Kerry out there making a fool of himself with telling flagrant lies about the situation in Iraq, just like Colin Powell did in his infamous speech to the UN. So there's really no difference at all between what's going on with the Obama regime in Syria and what happened 10 years ago with the Bush regime in Iraq. It's a different party. It's a different head of state. And we do see, I do think this particular regime, this Obama regime, would prefer to have the backing of the so-called international community. I really do think they would like to have the UN behind them. They'd like to have Congress behind them. They'd like to have American allies and junior partners and puppet states behind them. But if it doesn't happen, I think they'd still be willing to go to war in Syria on their own without all of that. So ultimately, there's really not that much difference, if any difference at all, between the liberal internationalists and the neocons, even as the liberal internationalists have eclipsed the neocons as the dominant foreign policy faction, as I predicted they would 10 years ago. Now, as far as this, the wider geopolitical implications of what's going on in Syria, and how we can relate that to some of the things we talk about and Attack the System. In that essay, Philosophical Anarchism and Death of Empire, I mentioned the possibility of an axis, a new axis emerging that would challenge the hegemony, the unipolar hegemony of the American Empire. Of course, ever since the Soviet Union died back in the early 90s, the United States has really been the world's lone superpower, unless you count China. China is really more of a regional power. But it does appear that Russia is certainly staking out a great deal of autonomy for itself within the context of the global system. And that, when the Soviet Union first fell apart, when Boris Yeltsin was the head of state there, Russian society was in terrible shape. The actual life expectancy in Russia actually went down from what it had been during the Soviet era. So that's quite an accomplishment if you can make your country poorer than the communists. But it happened once Boris Yeltsin's regime came into power in the early post-Soviet era in Russia. But over time, the largely under Putin's leadership, the Russia's been able to rebuild itself a little bit. Its economy has improved. It's asserting itself more in the international arena. And it does see that Russia is trying to carve out an independent sphere of influence for itself. And of course, this is something that the American empire has long dreaded. If you look at what happened after the Soviet Union rather fell apart, you see that and it lost its grip on all of the Warsaw Pact countries in Eastern Europe. You saw that the Americans rushed to expand the NATO alliance right up to the Russian border. They were essentially trying to encircle Russia once the Warsaw Pact fell apart. At the same time, within Russian domestic politics, there have been various thinkers and strategists there, particularly Alexander Dugin is one of the more prominent, who have sought to carve out an independent or sought to develop for Russia an independent foreign policy where it would carve out its own realm of geopolitical influence. And one thing that I mentioned in the essay, Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire 10 years ago, is the possibility of a new alliance emerging on a global basis that was opposed to the global unipolar America-led empire, and that would be led by nations like a counter alliance, if you will, that was led by nations like Russia and perhaps China, Brazil, India, some others. And that's really the ways things seem to be aligning up on a worldwide basis over this Syria question. We see this BRIC axis of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and so forth. We see a block of nations emerging that is opposed to the American empire, or at least opposed to having the American empire expanding its reach beyond a certain level. And with Syria now, Syria is a state, the Assad regime is a state that has been a client state, something of a client state of Russia in the past, and now Russia is asserting its own interests there. So it looks like a new type of, I won't say it's a Cold War, but a new type of well, I guess we could call it a Cold War. A new type of Cold War is developing between Russia and the United States over this question of how far the global empire that the Americans have started to carve out in the post-Cold War era, how far should that be expanded? The Russians are saying, no, that only goes so far. We oppose the expansion of NATO to our own borders. We want greater influence in the Middle East. We oppose American efforts to create a complete hegemony in the Middle East. And we do see this block of nations emerging that's opposed to some of these things, as I mentioned in that essay 10 years ago. So it's interesting to see how these things are developing. Now, another essay that I published some years ago, and I just referred to it a while back, and that was Liberty and Populism, Building an Effective Resistance Movement in North America. In the essay, Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire, I mean, that there's a lot of geopolitical analysis in there and historical analysis and so forth, but that's just a backdrop to the same thing that I'm always talking about, and that's how are we going to go about building a revolutionary anarchist movement on a worldwide basis. I mean, that's really the goal behind everything that we do at Attack the System. As our statement of purpose says, we aim to restore anarchism to the position that it held in the late 19th and early 20th century, and that is, it was the foremost revolutionary movement in the West, not only in the Western world, but in the colonial world as well. In the Third World, as was later called, it was the leading ideological force in the early anti-colonial movement, as well as in the as well as among domestic revolutionary movements in the Western states and during that time also. So that is our primary objective at AttackTheSystem.com, is to revive the old anarchist movement and modify it for a 21st century world, and develop it into the premier revolutionary movement worldwide, just like, say, Marxism was in the 20th century. That is our goal. Now, in Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire, I talk about that a great deal. I talk about the forms that might take and what its implications might be and all the different variables involved in that. And then a few years later, when I wrote Liberty and Populism, Building an Effective Resistance Movement in North America, I started trying to apply those ideas to American politics more directly and more specifically. And then a short time after that, I really started to develop the idea of pan-secessionism as the principal strategic tactic for a revolutionary anarchist movement, certainly in North America and perhaps in other parts of the world as well. And now it's interesting to see how some of the things that we have talked about for many years that attack the system are starting to gain some currency, and they're starting to gain something of a following, something of an audience. Of course, unfortunately, many of the geopolitical predictions that were outlined in Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire have since come into being. And also in Liberty and Populism, I talk about that as well. I talk about how the neocons would eventually be eclipsed by this alliance of the liberal internationalists on foreign policy on one hand and these so-called cultural Marxists on domestic policy on the other hand, the alliance between those two that was developed in the Democratic Party during the 1970s and the 1980s, that's now become the establishment. Unquestionably, it's become the establishment now that the neocons have started to recede into the background. And I predicted that would happen as well in Liberty and Populism, and that seems to be happening. This concept, this strategic concept of pan-secessionism seems to be growing also, and more I see references to ideas like pan-secessionism in a lot of different political camps. You know, I've seen discussions of pan-secessionism at Countercurrents, which is a far-right, neo-fascist-oriented website. I used to do these podcasts from there. They were gracious enough to allow me to broadcast on their network. I've also seen discussions of pan-secessionism in left anarchist circles, including left anarchist circles that are very hostile to attack the system. And that's great. I'm all for that. The idea behind the concepts that we promote is the concepts themselves, not self-promotion. For example, my purpose with Attack the System is not to create a bunch of Attack the System lovers. I do not view us as entertainers or people who are out there simply trying to be popular and build an audience for themselves. Rather, what matters is the ideas, and more and more we're starting to see these kinds of ideas, like pan-secessionism, like anarcho-pluralism, like the critique of what I've called totalitarian humanism. We're starting to see these kinds of concepts being introduced to an ever greater variety of political milieus, from the far-left neo-fascists to the far, from the far right neo-fascist to the far left anarchist, and lots of things in between. I keep seeing these concepts coming up in a lot more areas, including among groups that aren't affiliated with Attack the System, including among groups that have never had any kind of relationship with Attack the System, including among groups that are very opposed to Attack the System in many ways, and yet still these ideas keep expanding. They keep taking roots in ever more, an ever greater number of political movements, and among an ever greater number of ideological tendencies, and that's been the plan all along. That's what we've long tried to do at Attack the System: is promote these kinds of ideas and have them take root in all of these different kinds of political communities. The goal, of course, is to promote a pluralistic anarchism, that is, to promote all forms of anarchism, all forms of libertarianism, all forms of anti-state radicalism, of radical decentralization, of anti-authoritarianism, and just to promote dissent and hostility to the system generally, and tend to promote these wider strategic concepts like pan-secessionism, like libertarian populism, like the 10-core demographic theory, like fourth-generation warfare, doing all of these things with the purpose of eventually building mass movements on a worldwide basis that are capable of overthrowing the system. And this is a very, obviously, this is a very far-reaching vision that we have. And it's interesting to see how lots of different currents are starting to develop that have been impacted by some of these ideas. You know, I'm starting to see in alternative right circles certain discussions of ideas that we have introduced into that milieu. I'm starting to see discussions of this in the left anarchist milieu, including among people that have long been very hostile to us in many ways. For example, on our comments threads on Attack the System, that recently there have been discussions of Cascadia. Now, we had Vince, one of our co-editors, and a special guest, Casey Cochran, on just last week talking about the Cascadian movement. And, of course, we've also had Ryan Falk on the program from the All Nations Party, who's critical of the Cascadian movement. And yet we see both camps, to some degree, at least, endorsing this concept of pan-secessionism. The same thing is true with what we call totalitarian humanism. More and more, I'm starting to see that term crop up in a lot of different kinds of political circles, including circles that have no use for Attack the System, including among people who have no use for me personally. Yet that terminology continues to advance. And we can relate that to the present crisis in Syria as well. In the podcast that I did on Syria that some of you have heard or will hear soon, in that podcast I talk about how in many ways this represents, the Syria crisis represents, the foreign policy of totalitarian humanism, where imperialist war, aggressive imperialist war, is being justified on humanitarian grounds. Right, the idea that, oh, we've got to go in there and invade and conquer Syria, a sovereign nation, for the sake of humanity and humanitarian values. And I originally introduced the concept of totalitarian humanism into the wider anti-state milieu with an article I wrote in 2007 for LouRockwell.com. And if I were writing that article today, I think I might have a slightly different angle I would approach it from, although I'd still stand by the core ideas in there. And that is the idea that the dominant ruling paradigm that's emerging is one where the state legitimizes itself by claiming sovereignty over other institutions, by eradicating the sovereignty of counter institutions or of intermediary institutions or of civil society in the name of supposedly enforcing progressive values, and centralizing political authority to an ever greater degree for the sake of promoting ostensibly progressive values, and even engaging in aggressive war for the sake of enforcing ostensibly progressive values. And we see that now with what's going on in Syria. So all these things that we have talked about for many years at Attack the System, whether it's the geopolitical paradigm that we've outlined, the strategic paradigm we've outlined, the critique of the emerging enemy ideology that we have advanced, all of these things are starting to converge now. And we do see very slowly the kinds of movements that we have advocated for starting to develop in a lot of different camps. And I was talking about this with some of our associates recently, and I tend to be of the view that as concepts like anarcho-pluralism, as concepts like pan-secessionism, as concepts like our criticisms of totalitarian humanism continue to spread, as these ideas continue to find their way into an ever greater number of populations, I think what we will see is a lot of different currents developing on their own. Of course, I've always advocated for strategic alliances against the system in a way that spans across conventional cultural and ideological boundaries. These kinds of cross-cultural, cross-ideological alliances against common enemies. I've established a fairly well-known position for myself but for advocating these. But the way I see things evolving, I think that what we will see is lots of different types of movements growing up that are in many ways influenced by these ideas, but aren't necessarily connected to one another, and are in fact perhaps hostile to one another. For instance, I could see left-wing anti-totalitarian humanist and right-wing anti-totalitarian humanist tendencies developing that are certainly against the totalitarian humanist ideological paradigm of the ruling class, but at the same time are critical of each other as well. There may be a pro-Cascadian secession movement developing. There may be an anti-Cascadian secession movement developing. There may be a pro-Southern nationalist movement developing that advocates for pan-secessionism. There may be an anti-Southern nationalist movement developing. There may be anti-pluralists with a national, there may be anarcho-pluralists with a national anarchist outlook. There may be anarcho-pluralists with a left anarchist or even Antifa outlook. I see these kinds of things starting to develop in a lot of different types of camps, and I think these ideas will find their way into an ever greater variety of political communities. And all of them won't necessarily converge with one another immediately. They'll continue to be rivals with one another in many different ways. But ultimately, what the concept of a grand alliance of pan-secession, of revolutionary forces using the pan-secessionist tactic, what all of that is about is not simply building alliances for the sake of doing it or because all of these groups need to love each other or anything like that. Rather, as these kinds of movements develop, as any kind of resistance movement develops, whether it's any kind of anarchism, libertarianism, anti-state radicalism, whether it's Cascadia, whether it's Southern nationalism, whether it's black nationalism, whether it's the alternative right, whether it's the Tea Party or Occupy Wall Street or Ron Paul or whatever, as these kinds of movements or movements influenced by these things start to develop, more and more and more they will come under the attack of the state as the state comes to view these kinds of growing movements as a threat. We see the system losing its legitimacy right before our eyes. 10 years ago, when I wrote Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire, the American state had a lot more legitimacy in the eyes of most Americans than it does at present. Right? 7 years ago, when I wrote Liberty and Populism, Building an Effective Resistance Movement for North America, the American state had more legitimacy than it does at present. I would say probably 3 years ago, when I wrote the essay Anarcho-Pluralism and Pan-Secessionism, What They Are and What They Are Not, I would argue at that point the American regime probably had more legitimacy in the eyes of the public than it does now. The system continues to lose its legitimacy. The system, I see polls from time to time that show that Congress's approval rating is in the single digits. We're rapidly approaching a situation, certainly in the United States, and I would argue in many other parts of the world as well, where the system just simply has no legitimacy, where no one takes it seriously, no one has any respect for it. But the question is, when the system finally gives way, I mean, no system can survive if most of its people do not support it or do not have any respect for it. That just can't be. Civilizations, societies don't function in that way. Right? So when the system finally gives way, the big question is, what will be the new system? What will be the post-system system? And that is one of the primary, if not the primary, question that we at Attack the System try to address, because we see that the system is doomed. We see that the system cannot survive in its present form forever. There is no way that the system in its present form, with all of the issues and dysfunctions that it has, can survive in its present form. It's like a patient in a hospital whose vital organs are failing. That is not going to be a situation that can endure forever. Just like a patient in a hospital whose vital organs are failing will die eventually, so will a system whose vital institutions are failing, so will a system of that type die eventually. So the question is, when the system dies, what will come in its place? That is what we at Attack the System are primarily about trying to address. And we do that through promoting dissident movements of all different kinds, through promoting tactical ideas, strategic ideas that can help to bury the system, and also coming up with ideas like anarcho-pluralism about what a post-system system might be. And that's an immensely important question, because when systems die, they do not necessarily die an easy death. For instance, when the Soviet Union died. When the Soviet Union died, as I said earlier, the average life expectancy in Russia went down to even below what it was under communist rule. We know what happened when the Weimar Republic failed back in the 1920s. And the American political system seems to be headed in a similar direction in terms of an ostensible liberal democracy that has failed through loss of its own legitimacy because of its own incompetence. We see that happening. And we can point to many other past scenarios. And, of course, when states fall apart, terrible things can happen. A new state can emerge that's just as tyrannical and abusive and oppressive as the state that it replaced, or a society can collapse into civil war. You can have multiple faction civil wars. That's what happened to Lebanon famously during the 1980s. You had dozens of factions fighting with each other over all sorts of things. That is what Attack the System was, an American Revolutionary Vanguard. That's what we were formed in large part to try to prevent, to reform, to recognize the system is doomed, to promote alternative political ideas, to promote strategies for achieving them, and to have some alternative system in place or have plans for an alternative system in place. And, of course, anarcho-pluralism is also about promoting anarchism. As anarchists, we are interested in promoting our own philosophy, of course. But even more so than that, I think, anarcho-pluralism is about being practical. It's about recognizing that there are so many different types of beliefs and so many different types of cultures, so many different types of ideological systems and political preferences and so forth, that there is no universal system that is right for everyone. Whatever kind of system replaces the current paradigm of centralized mass democracy, whatever it is going to have to be something that takes that into account if it's going to be a successful system. In our statement of purpose, there is a brief essay towards the end of that called Wisdom and Vision. I actually read a little bit of this in the interview I did with Casey Cochran when Vince and I were talking to Casey. But Vision and Wisdom is from Chris George's blog. Chris is a libertarian anarchist, and I thought this was a great essay that Chris actually lifted it from someone else, another anarchist who has not been identified. But I'm going to read this again, because this really speaks to our vision of the future at Attack the System. And this is a left anarchist, anarcho-communist speaking here. I think that the notion that all of humanity will ever be operating under the same flag, so to speak, is astonishingly stupid and demonstrates a complete lack of understanding of humanity and a dumbfounding ignorance of history. It frankly astounds me that the intelligent folks manage to convince themselves that the future Earth will be entirely syndicalist or entirely transhumanist or entirely mutualist or entirely rewilded or entirely fill in the blank. I've described myself as an anarcho-ecumenist, but I fly the Red Star because the ANCOM belief is the closest to the system I would personally like to live in. That system may be made of 100 people or 100 million. I have no way of predicting the future, and neither does anyone else. I do make some very broad predictions, however. I think that the future will be a world of dizzying social complexity, replete with small city-states with governments ranging the gamut from democratic to monarchical to theocratic, surrounded by vast hinterlands filled with eco-villages and wild ranges where hunter-gatherer humans chase wild game and forage for nuts and berries, while vast trade fleets of ultralight zeppelins transfer goods and services all over the planet, and transhuman consciousness zips through endless, decentralized computer networks maintained by industrial syndicates, a million workers strong, who build satellites and launch them into orbit to maintain a global network of communication so primitivists can use cell phones to trade furs for plastic composite bows and so on. Personally, I wish I was there right now. In the immediate moment, I'm willing to ally myself with anyone who believes that humans are capable of developing large-scale systems that can be entirely consensus-based. I don't think these social technologies exist yet, and so I'm working towards trying to figure them out. The answers lie across a dozen different flavors of anarchism, and the only way to even begin is to respect A, each other's opinions, and B, our differences and similarities, and C, the fact that we don't have all the answers yet. If we did, we'd already be doing it. It always struck me as incredibly stupid to say, we agree on 97% of everything, but we have different notions of what the word trade means. So you are therefore my bitter enemy. It's a crock of shit, but it's worse than stupid. It's counterproductive. We're working towards a very different world than the one we live in, and we need 100% of the people involved to be, you know, actually working towards it, even if someone thinks your direction is 15 degrees removed from their compass bearing, you're still pretty much headed in the same direction. I'd like to think that my unabashed outreach to the pacifists, Christians, primitivists, transhumanists, mutualists, ANCAPs, and everyone else is beginning to pick up speed, but there's only so far the mass mentality can be pushed without a profound systemic change in the way people perceive their potential allies. Granted, there's a lot of room for improvement in relations between the different flags, but on the other hand, to compare to what we agree on, it's actually not that much. And of course, that's a great statement that was from the essay Vision and Wisdom from Chris George's blog, A New Kind of Mind, and it really, I think, in many ways summarizes what we're all about here at AttackTheSystem.com, and it's all about promoting these ideas for a post-system system, something that will be productive and positive when the system finally gives way. And it's interesting to go back and look at some of our past documents that have been published at Attack the System over the last 10 or 12 years and see how things have developed in the time since some of those things were published, since Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire was published in 03, since National Anarchy and the American Idea was published that same year, since Liberty and Populism was published in 2006, since The New Totalitarians, where I introduced the concept of totalitarian humanism, was published at lewrockwell.com in 2007. Since the article on anarcho-pluralism and pan-secessionism, what they are and what they are not, was introduced in 2010, we continue to see the world society, the geopolitical situation, and the political situation escalating and developing in the way outlined and predicted by those writings. We see the neocons have been eclipsed. The liberal internationalists are in power. You know, their alliance with the cultural Marxists, with the totalitarian humanists, has become ever more solidified. They are continuing the aggression of the empire in an unabashed way. Meanwhile, the domestic march towards full-on totalitarianism continues to develop and unfold uninterrupted, And we see the kinds of resistance ideas that we have promoted at AttackTheSystem.com starting to take root in more cultures and more political tendencies, very slowly, very gradually, but they're out there, and they're finding their way into an ever greater number of populations and political groups and demographics and so forth. Now, as far as the concept of this grand alliance that I've talked about in the past, ultimately what will solidify that alliance is when the system starts to really strike back. I've mentioned that on the day of the revolution, it should be folks like Ed Snowden, folks like Julian Assange, like Chelsea Manning, like Glenn Greenwald, like David Miranda. It should be those people who are on the balcony, those people that are out there on the front lines taking the greatest number of blows in the war against the system. But unfortunately, the system is going to come after more and more people from all over the political spectrum as the system starts to break down and as dissident movements start to grow. Things that we've seen in the past, Tea Parties, Occupy Wall Street, the Ron Paul movement, that's just the beginning of what's to come. The militia movement, that's just the beginning of what's to come. The alternative right, that's just the beginning. The anarchists, the anti-globalization movement, all these kinds of things are just the beginning of what's to come. There's going to be a whole lot of different kinds of these movements growing up, and they're all going to have, as their one common aim, opposition to the system, and the system is going to feel threatened. The system is going to hit back and hit hard. And that is when all of these different kinds of resistance forces need to coalesce in some tactical, pragmatic way for mutual defense. And that is why, in my judgment at least, the concept of anarcho-pluralism as a meta-political paradigm, the concept of pan-secessionism as a meta-strategic paradigm, that's why these things become so vitally important. Because our goal is, as the system breaks down, we're going to replace the system with federations of micronations and municipalities and independent communities that may reflect a wide panoply of a wide umbrella of value systems. As the comments from Vision and Wisdom that I just read reflect, you know, that's our vision for the world of the future, more or less. Right? But to get there, we've got to have some sort of mutual defensive alliance against these common enemies, you know, a jihad against the empire, if you will. For those of you that are Star Wars fans, it's just like the scene in that movie where, you know, you've got the all-out assault on the Death Star by the rebel forces, Luke Skywalker and his friends and all that. I mean, that's all science fiction, that's entertainment, but that's really not far removed from what we're trying to do in the situation that we're rapidly approaching. So that's what we're about at Attack the System, and things are continuing to escalate, and the things that we've been talking about for years are continuing to develop and unfold, unfortunately, along the lines that we've long predicted. Now, as I said earlier, sometimes it sucks to be right. So with that in mind, this has been Keith Preston for AttackTheSystem.com. This has been our weekly podcast. Be sure to check out our weekly news updates that come out from time to time. Check out our other podcasts. If you've missed past podcasts, you can go into our archives at AttackTheSystem.com. Any kind of support you want to send us, financial or otherwise, is always welcome. And until next time, have a good week.